Views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
With early detection comes early prevention.
Put lead in your pencil, make you feel like a champion.
Rise up again, let nothing keep you down. To live your best,
hear the urologist
speak. Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Think you're losing grip of your mind, and don't give up on hope.
Don't be ashamed, it's time to take control. Get some help from the urologist.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. I am pleased to have as my guest this evening a friend and colleague who I've known for more than 30 years. We were in medical school together in Mona, Jamaica over 30 years ago. Time really does fly. Also on a personal note, his daughter, who is with his ex-wife, is my cousin's stepdaughter, and that cousin, who is actually more like a brother to me. So in essence, this is Dr. Tennille Cargill. Your daughter is truly like my niece. So Dr. Tennille Cargill is well known in all circles, very well respected Bahamian, contributed on many levels, particularly in the medical fraternity. He has been very vocal, and he's been inspiration to many in speaking about his journey, his cancer journey, with lung cancer, and that's exactly what he's here to do, to be an inspiration, to be a beacon of hope and light to those who are suffering from cancer, who are those who have recovered from cancer. And we're just going to have an open discussion, Tennille. And welcome to the show, and I hope you come again.
Okay, thank you. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, the Bahamas. Thank you, Dr. Pinto, for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So let's, obviously, your journey is very personal to you, and we'll only delve into details that you're willing to get into. But essentially, where did all of this start? You started with symptoms, you did tell me, of fatigue and maybe some shortness of breath or a cough. I don't know if it was productive or non-productive. But how long did that go on for before you went on for further testing?
Backtrack a little. At the time, end of March, I was traveling on behalf of the government, Bahamas Air, and I did feel fatigued on when I landed in Florida. I didn't think anything of it. Fairly healthy person, just to put some context in there. And that night, I got something to eat, early rest. Woke up the next day feeling a little more fatigued and started to develop some sniffling. And as you know, a truly, truly Bahamian that I am, self-medicated, started to take some over-the-counter meds for the stuffiness. And I just thought, okay, maybe I'm coming down with that bad flu that was going around. And then I had just traveled, so I said, okay, maybe I caught a bug while on the plane. You know, I was just going through all of these diagnoses in my head. Being a physician didn't help because I didn't think anything of it. You know, went on through my day. Yes, I did develop a non-productive cough that evening. The fatigue turned into slight, you know, fever. So I said, okay, let me rest up some more, take some more over-the-counter meds. Next day comes along, got caught in the rain. You know, I figured, okay, that made it worse. This was the weekend of the Palm Beach Boat Show. So I just want to put in context that when this was, so that the listeners can get some idea of the rapidity of how this took place and then getting to the diagnosis, getting to the management.
Okay.
And just keeping it in that context. And so let's say that would have been the Sunday, got caught in the rain, got a raincoat, left the boat show, went back to my room. You know, I figured I'd thug it out, took some more over-the-counter meds. I had a pack, a Z-Pack, and just for the sake of the listeners, this is azithromycin. I said, let me start this. It's an atypical antibiotic. And so I said, okay, you know, I'm coming down with a flu. And that night, I started to develop some pleurisy with the cough. And so just for the listener's sake, this is as if when you cough, someone has a knife and they're dragging it down your chest wall while you're coughing.
Very painful, yes.
Very painful. And I'm like, okay, something's wrong here, right? I have a pneumonia, a bronchitis, something of the sort. So being a doctor there again, you know, wasn't the best case scenario for me, because here I am again creating this differential and how I'm going to treat myself.
Yes, yes.
And I'm traveling. So, you know, I'm like, okay, tug it out some more on the meds. The next day, so that was the Sunday, that would have been the 29th of March, was the VJ Edgecombe game there when all of the Bahamas is converging on Florida. And so I'm excited now. I'm feeling a bit ill, you know, the cough subsided. And I was like, I could get to the game. I want to go and watch VJ, you know. My kid's mom flew in at the time. She wanted to go to the game as well. And so we went to the game. You know, got through the game feeling great. You know, got back to the room feeling lethargic now. I figured, okay, I overexerted myself. I'm leaving the next day. So I'm like, okay, let me get some rest, because I had a board meeting the next day for Bahamas Air. I'm saying, I'm going to go to the board meeting. I'm going to get better, get back on the plane. I'm going to get on the first thing smoking out of Florida back to Nassau. I didn't want to get sick in the States. I didn't want to get worse in the States if I were to, right?
Okay.
Anyway, next day comes along. I'm feeling really horrible that morning. I actually second-guessed leaving. I was like, I want to rest up. And then something got into me, and I was like, you know what? Let me get to the airport. So I got on the first Bahamas Air flight smoking out of Miami into Nassau. And then I landed, and it was as if more symptoms compounded this overly fatigue feeling that I had. So I said, okay, I'm going to miss this board meeting. I called my chairman. I said, you know, Chairman Pratt, I can't make it. I'm not feeling well. You know, send my regards to the board members. And I went home. You know, I bypassed my own clinic. I went home, rested up, felt that, you know, I'll be okay. Continue self-medicating. I didn't call a friend, text a friend, colleague, you know, if I should come in at the time. But I knew that I had to get some form of intervention, medical intervention. And so I said to myself, when I go into work, I am going to make sure that, you know, I tell my assistant, Marilyn, make sure that I get an x-ray. So, you know, let's say a few days goes by. God had it where I didn't feel good enough not to do the testing.
Okay.
And so I stick a pin there, because I'm going to come back to that, right? Because knowing that I'm self-medicating, self-diagnosis, you know, as Bahamians, you're thinking the least of the scenario. Okay, what if it's a pneumonia? As a physician, I'm thinking, okay, antibiotics, I'm already on it. I'll be all right. You know, so eventually go into work. That would have been the following. So I went the Saturday. I did not go in for the x-ray on the Saturday. I just was lounged on my couch in my office, and I was like, okay, let's see if I can make it till, you know, I think Monday was a holiday. So the Tuesday, when I went in on that Tuesday, so now in context now, I'm 1 week out.
Okay.
From my travel. All right, I bought all this time, and I was lollygagging. And
you were completely fine before that week?
I was completely fine.
No,
before that week.
No. Nothing. Weight loss, no.
Nothing.
Okay.
Mentioning weight loss, just so that I can also put in context for the listeners who, and over the years, persons that have known my weight fluctuation, I practice something called intermittent fasting.
Okay.
I've done that for many years. It was a healthy lifestyle change that I was deliberate about. And successful in losing weight, dropped from about 240 pounds down to, at one point, as low as 160. Realizing that that was a bit too low. I beefed up a little bit, and I hovered around 172. And that's where I remained.
Okay.
And I was on an OMAD diet, so one meal a day is what OMAD references or stands for. And my body, I cut out sugar. I think that, you know, the listeners really need to appreciate processed sugar and its role in cancer, the feeding of cancer organisms.
Well, we're going to get into modifiable, non-modifiable risk factors, but let's hear the rest of your story.
So anyway, I go into work that Tuesday, and I did, like I said, Marilyn, you know, make sure before the end of the day I go and, you know, get an x-ray. You know, I said, you can call Fort Terrace, call Oak Tree, just let them know I'm coming. You know, so Marilyn called Dr. Darville's clinic, Fort Terrace. Said, hey, Doc is going to come in. Seeing some patients because I actually started seeing patients.
Wow.
I was feeling good enough to see some patients. And I think that's purposefully, you know, it's a part of our calling, right?
Yes.
We always put others before self.
Yeah.
And so I'm not
coughing. So yeah, I would say doctors make the worst patients.
Make the worst patients, my brother. But that holistic side of me, I knew that from the perspective of how know your body, I knew that, okay, I wasn't myself.
But you were probably thinking pneumonia before anything else.
Yeah. I was actually a bit afraid, right,
yes.
Of a pneumonia.
Okay.
Because I'd never been really sick like that before, yes. Right? So I'm like, okay, the worst thing I'm going to see on this x-ray, Dr. Pinto, is...
So when were you alerted that there was some concern with the x-ray? Was that right away?
So I had finished the Z-Pak, right? I had finished the azithromycin, right, the day before.
Okay.
And I said, okay, Marilyn, I'm going to leave. I want to pick up some levofloxacin because I'm not quite good yet. Still in the back of my head trying to self-medicate. And she said, hey, they're waiting on you at Four Terrace.
Okay. Thank goodness for her.
Right. She was like, now I must backtrack a bit, right? So my kid's mom did say when we were away, you better make sure you do an x-ray, right? If I'm being very truthful. But there again... You know, Marilyn was like, listen, man, do not pass go. Do not collect that $200.
Okay.
Go and do this x-ray. All right. So went to Fort Terrace, did the x-ray, confirmed the pneumonia, right? And then the technician and the radiologist at the time stated that they saw something suspicious at the top of the lung, the apical portion of the lung. And I'm there like, okay, what could that be? What could that be? And so he's going through his head. And obviously, now, I'm requesting this x-ray myself, right?
Yes.
So you know, he's saying to me, listen, doc, our CT radiologist and team are still on. I think we need to get you down to the CT facility.
Okay.
Are you able to go there? I was like, oh, yeah, of course. You know, I got a pneumonia. What else could it be? Got to Grosvenor's and did the CT. And I was called into, so now remember now, this is around probably 5-something now.
Okay.
Okay, in the evening. And so I did the CT with contrast. So all of this is a new experience to me now because I've had x-rays before, chest x-rays and x-rays. I've never had a CT, a chest CT before, and I've never had contrast.
Yes.
And anybody's had contrast, they know that they got that very warm feeling about your body and a slight nauseation. So I'm like, man, this contrast is making me feel worse than the actual, whatever it is, the pneumonia,
yes.
Or whatever they're yes. suspiciously looking at. So they call me in the side room, and they're just like, yeah, okay, we're confirmed. There's something there that we need to be concerned about. Mm-hmm. Didn't go into too much specifics. They said, you know, who would be the physician? Obviously, we can't send it to you.
Yes.
Of choice. And I said, well, immediately, Dr. Sands has been integral in the healthcare of my family, my dad, family members. I said, listen, just send it to Dr. Sands.
And so once Dr. Sands saw the imaging, how did he get a hold of you? Was it a phone call? Did you
yeah,
see him personally?
Well, you know, anybody that knows Dr. Yeah. Dwayne Sands, right? He's a straight shooter.
Yes.
All right. And he leaves nothing unarticulated. And time, obviously, it was sensitive. So Dr. Sands called at about 9 o'clock that night.
Okay.
And he was like, hey, I don't like what I see. Be in my office in the morning, 9 o'clock.
Okay.
You know, I was like,
how was that night waiting to see Dr. Sands?
I was like, you know, okay. You know, I'm just thinking this is a complicated pneumonia now, right?
Okay.
And I got some nodes or something.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, some of the angst sort of kicked in overnight. I did sleep,
okay.
You know, I did sleep. And the next morning, I didn't call any family members at that moment. That's a very important point, too, because I want to come back to that.
So you're dealing with it alone?
I'm dealing with it alone.
Okay.
I'm dealing with it alone.
So it must be a terrifying experience.
Yeah, but I think I'm sort of guarded by being a physician.
Yes.
So I'm like, I'm going through these things and I'm being positive about it. And I'm thinking, what if I gave this information to a patient? You know what I mean? what's the worst thing that could be, you know. So, yeah, I did go through a lot of thoughts. I was alone with this processing.
So what were the words that changed your life forever when you went to see Dr. Sands?
Well, the next morning, the words that started the change in my life was I messaged Dr. Sands the next morning, and I said, hey, doc, can I come in alone, or do you recommend I bring a family member? And he said, wrote back, you could come with somebody.
Okay.
So right then, it sort of hit me.
It was serious.
Like, yes. A ton of bricks.
Okay.
You know, how serious, I still didn't know.
Okay.
But I knew, he said, you know, bring a support team.
So when you did see him, the word cancer was something that he brought up, or did he thought that it was a possibility, or he thought that it was almost a certainty?
He said to me, and I quote, Tanil, this is malignancy until I tell you otherwise.
Okay. Which is cancer, yes.
Which is cancer.
Yes.
Yes. And
did he go into the extent of it, the possible staging?
At the time,
what structures or organs were involved?
So from what he saw, he stated that it was on the left side of my chest, the left lung. He articulated node involvement in the apex at the time. From what he can see from the imaging, he stated there seemed to be two at the top, the apex,
yes,
of the lung. He said in the base of my lung, it appeared to be obstructed.
Okay.
So there was one at the base, but it was more both obviously a cancerous mass and an obstructive mass obviously at the same time. Also articulated that seemed to have been this way possibly over, and if he were to put in context a time frame, maybe the past 2-3 years.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
And what about involvement of surrounding structures? Was there any extensions to the thorax, the heart?
Yes. So he stood us behind him, with him looking at the, and when I said us, at the time, my eldest sister, Marie, and my brother Tony were able to come with me that morning. Candace wasn't able to come initially. And so they were there.
Okay.
And he stood us behind us and he said, listen, imagine we're standing at the foot of the bed and we're looking at Tanil from his feet to his head. And he went through the slices on the screen. And he showed where the ribs were involved, that the third rib was sort of mothy.
Okay.
Okay. And he showed where the outline of the size, I think he might have said something like the largest one was like a navel orange or something like that. I don't want to misquote him. I think it was something like that, right? In the top part of the lung. And then that the base was pretty much totally occluded, that I was not using the base of my lungs.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then what were the next steps? What were the possible interventions that were presented to you?
All right. So keeping...
Well, let's say just from an emotional standpoint.
Right.
How are you handling things?
Yeah. Right now, I'm always on the other side of this table, right? Yeah. So I'm the one that would have been in Dr. Sands' position.
Well, I mean, obviously the word devastation is an understatement. Yes.
It's an understatement.
I'm sure your first thing you're thinking of is your five children. You're thinking about
every possible,
your life.
Yes.
Your
every
survival, trying to be there for them.
Every possible thought ran through my head at once. And if anybody follows cricket, you know, I was knocked for six. The wind was knocked out of me. I'm standing there. Now, let's keep everything in context still, because I'm the man, I'm the provider, I'm the brother, I'm the big brother, the little brother, the daddy, the husband. At the time, I'm going through a separation, Candace and I, you know, going through our separation. Everything that could go wrong was going wrong, and then this.
Well, I mean, I would like to applaud you for your honesty and your being so forthright. I think you inspire a lot of people who feel like the whole world has fallen on their shoulders.
And oh, yeah.
They're not alone. There are a lot of people who are facing tragedies, and unfortunately, many of them face it silently.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Bahamians and residents who face cancer, and because they want to keep it a secret, they'll even spend more money and go off to United States or Canada or United Kingdom, where they have little or no family support, just because they want that secrecy. And I think almost immediately you reached out to several people, and then you reached out. I know your daughter reached out with trying to raise funds, because it's going to be a huge undertaking for you to survive this.
Yeah. We
got to say the support has been overwhelmingly positive.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So everything that could go wrong is going wrong. I don't have health insurance. All of these things.
Well, I think that's another thing you can inspire people to know.
Oh, yeah.
That. And I see it all the time. You see it all the time.
Yes.
That you are a successful businessman. You are successful in your practice. You've branched out. You're the chair. You're in the board on Bahamas here, and many other. Mm-hmm. Other things, and obviously you could have gotten insurance. So that's just an oversight. So we
was
always
it an
think,
oversight. I let it lapse and I let it ride.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But we want to emphasize to those out there that is all important.
So important,
particularly if you have family, because it can financially devastate you as an individual and your family as well. So imagine facing cancer and trying to support a loved one, and on top of that, trying to finance it, that just makes it 10 times worse.
If I could even drive and drill that down a bit more. If you were thinking about getting insurance, you're healthy as far as you're concerned, and you have breath in you, don't put that back, don't put that off any further.
Life insurance as well.
Life insurance.
If you have children. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Both. Both medical insurance, life insurance. Go out there and start that conversation with your agents. If you know, we live in the Bahamas. I mean, I'm sure there's someone you can call about how do I feel to the information necessary regarding insurance and getting up to date with my medical insurance. That's very important. And like Dr. Pinto said, you know, you never really want to leave these burdens on anyone, because in this process of, in me processing all of this information, I will say this. Had I not asked Dr. Sands that question, should I bring somebody, and had I gone there by myself, I told this to my eldest sister and two of my brothers, Tony and Arnold. I said, you know, I said, had I gone there alone and the gravity and the weight of the situation upon me, I might have fallen in the trap of keeping it a secret. And it's so interesting that you said that a while ago. Because I'm thinking, I don't want to burden my family. I don't want to burden anybody with this information. Let me just hold this. Let me ride this out. And hey, you know.
And I mean, your whole life, you've been thought of as a power of strength for your patients, for those in the community, obviously for your children. You don't want to have someone pitying you and worrying about you and everything else.
So when you think about it, for me, I always use that phrase that 50 Cent says, I am the person I have to go home and get.
Yes.
And so who am I going to go and call, you know, go home and get me, you know, and that is the, that is a part of why this, me being so vocal right now and turning this experience into, a message of hope, drilling down on some of the things that you can do to prevent being in this position and being the voice that a lot of people need to hear, that may be the stimulus, the catalyst to get them into the doctor's office.
Well, do you ever think that maybe God saw it as you were going to be a warrior for this journey, for this battle?
Yeah, so you know, as a physician, we tend to downplay this, but when you look at health, you have to look at it from its entirety, from the panoramic scope of health, which is both the mental, the physical, yes, but it's also the mental and the spiritual.
Well, I'll say that lung cancer may have started the fight, but you will finish it, and I'm sure you're going to be triumphant.
Oh, yeah.
So let's continue the story. Within a week, I understand you had surgery. What was that, the days leading up to that, and what was surgery day like, and what was it like after the surgery?
So we're in the office, right? On that same day, and this is divine This is a divine process because while I'm there, devastated, I am strong. I'm sitting there like, okay, we can tackle this. And I looked at Dr. Sands and I was like, hey, bro, let's be aggressive. He was like, okay, how does Friday look? So now this is Tuesday.
Yes.
And I was like, what Friday? He was like, and I can laugh about it now, but I wasn't laughing then. He was like, you know, this Friday, you want to be aggressive. Let's go in and let's tackle this. And he said that this is a journey ranging anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million to keep you alive. This is going to be over the next year, 2 years. And we're going to start now.
Wow.
You know, and so...
At what point were you able to have a discussion with your kids? I know you have younger kids.
I do.
Have them privy to all these details, or you try to shield them as a father would?
So he asked me the question, is there anybody you'd like for me to speak to? And I said, okay, at the time, like I said, my youngest kid's mom, Candace, was not there.
Yes.
In this meeting while my eldest sister and my brother Tony was. And so I said, yeah, give her a call. You know, let her know. I want everybody to know at this point.
Okay.
That are close enough. And so I knew that I had to call Sadie. That's the mom of my eldest son, Jaden. I knew that I had to call Janelle and Warren. We co-parent Jayla, my beautiful daughter. And I knew that Dr. Sands would assist me in articulating this to Candace. And then by extension for my 9-year-old, my 6-year-old, my 9-year-old Jackson, my 6-year-old Justice, and my 4-year-old Jaira. And that moment that you're thinking, damn, I have a lot to live for.
Yeah. I mean, there must be a flurry of emotions from depression, anxiety, and panic attacks. I'm sure you had insomnia.
Yeah.
I mean, the emotional challenge is almost inevitable with any cancer diagnosis, yes.
You go through a fleeting amount of emotions. You go through the questioning of self. You go through the questioning of your faith.
Yes.
I ask God, why?
Yes.
Why me? I am the person that has always been there for everybody.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I've always been...
You've uplifted the health of the nation over the decades.
And through the purpose of and the passion of my profession, I meet people at a point of brokenness. And, you know, they come in with a physical problem, but there's a mental and a spiritual component to that. And you meet them there. I'm that person.
Yes.
And now I'm in that seat.
But they always say, as long as your body's healthy, you always seem to have hundreds of problems that weigh down on your mind, that causes distractions in your life, that problems that may sap out the joy of your existence. But in the moment you get diagnosed with cancer or face a serious health crisis or serious health event, suddenly you only have one problem. All the other hundreds of problems become insignificant, meaningless. They just instantly disappear because they have really no significance in your life or your future whatsoever. So I think many of us do not appreciate all the good things that we have in life. It sometimes takes facing even possible mortality that gives us a new insight. I think you have a clarity of thought that very few people have, that you know what is important, you know what you need to drive for, and you are going to overcome this. We're going to talk about the positivity of a very good diagnosis in terms of the pathology that you received. Mm-hmm. And the outlook on it. But I think that you have a unique perspective where essentially every day of your life for the rest of your life, let's hope you get another 40, 50 years, is a gift. And I'm sure you're going to treat it like a gift and you're going to embrace every moment with your 5 kids. You're going to embrace every moment with your family. You're going to embrace every moment that life has to offer you. And you may not have had that. You might have just gone through life like all of us, being obsessed with problems that really are not problems whatsoever.
I you know, Dr. Pinto, I think, and let me call you Greg because, you know, you're my boy. For the sake of this discussion, you know, I think that this puts into, I guess, context the difference between perception and perspective. All right, you always have this perception that I have all these things that are so important, this hierarchy of burdens. Yeah. I gotta tackle this and I gotta tackle that. And
well,
this is important.
As you were just very forthcoming, you were having some marital issues and everything else. I'm sure a lot of people would never have known because you were holding that within.
Yes.
And you were just pushing through. But that's what so many of us in our society and throughout the world, you don't know what someone is
going through.
You don't know what they're silently dealing with.
Yeah.
And they're just a moment away from breaking.
Yeah.
And you just have to give people empathy. And if they're having an off day, maybe you get to maybe think about maybe if you walk in their shoes, what might be happening in their life.
Yeah. And I
understanding.
Think about it as we walk through life. That's why it's so important that when you see people, you meet people, be kind first. Because literally you don't know what it is that they're going through.
Yes.
Give them that smile that may change their entire outlook on the rest of the day. You know?
And then when we even talk about success, people will say, all right, you have a wonderful practice. You have this car, you have this watch, you have this beautiful woman on your arm, you have this, you always have the fancy clothes, you're always out, you're going this, traveling that. When we talk about materialism and we talk about the importance of materialism, there's so much more to life than materialism. I remember reading that what Steve Jobs was a billionaire, founder of Apple, when reportedly upon reflecting on his life near the time of his death, he basically, and I'm going to paraphrase, basically emphasized that material wealth is insignificant compared to health, relationship, and happiness. And then he also went on and shared five key insights, which he had called undeniable truths. And again, paraphrasing, he said, number one, educate children to be happy, not rich. Yeah. So you want to seek happiness, true happiness, not materialism. You're not, materialism is shallow. We all come into this world with nothing, naked. And we're all going to leave. And he also said that eat food as medicine. So you have to eat healthy now, so you do not have to eat medicine
later
as a food later. Value the people who love you.
Yes.
Because not everyone's going to want the best for you.
No.
I remember one of my mentors, Dr. Charles Diggus, once said, it's lonely at the top. Greg, the more success you're going to have, the fewer people are going to be happy for you, the more people that you thought were your friends are going to turn against you. And that's reality. It's unfortunate. And then he also said, true happiness comes from connection. So you need to, when you're on your deathbed, all of us are going to die one day. 100 years from now, none of us on this earth are going to be here. Right. What are in our minds is not going to be what BMW we had.
No.
It's not what Rolex we had or how many hours we spend in the office and how many millions of dollars we have in the bank or what property we bought, what business we had. We're going to think about the impact we had on our family, our children, our legacy, the love that we had with our loved ones. Those are what are in our mind. And what we would want in that moment is to have more of that. Yeah. Not more of the money, not more materialism, more of the emotional connections.
Yeah.
And I think you have that clarity of thought where you're going to treasure every moment.
So I've always taught my kids, time is your most valuable resource. Use it wisely. And I think that could not ring more true than now. And that's why I use the example of, you know, perception versus perspective. And also, I want to say this, and I'm talking about the depth of introspection. Use these opportunities to be alone. And I'm not speaking about being lonely. Be alone. Be with self. Introspect. Dig deep. Ask yourself those difficult questions. Foster the relationship with self where you know who I am as a person and what do I want in this life. And then it goes right back to what Steve Jobs and many persons before Steve and after Steve will continuously say, relationships.
And the last thing Steve Jobs did also say in terms of undeniable truths is the importance of a work-life balance.
Yes.
Obviously, you have to work because you have to survive. You got to provide. You want to have a better future for an existence for your children than the one that you had.
Yeah.
And just as your parents wanted a better life for you and myself and everybody else than they had, and you want your children to stand on your shoulders. Yeah. They want to be a legacy. So you want to give them all. But sometimes you don't want to give them too much.
Yeah.
That is a folly as well, because if you give them too much, when you look at, for example, the importance, the meaning of life, you can't have an easy life and have really true happiness and self-fulfillment. So show me any trust fund kid who had millions of dollars given to them at a young age and never had to work for anything in their life, always had everything handed to them, never had to solve a problem, never saw a dark day in their life. I will then show you someone who is mentally and emotionally tortured, and their soul is tortured.
Yeah.
So it's not the pursuit of happiness. It is the happiness of the pursuit. So the self-fulfillment and true joy of striving for goals in life and sacrificing and fighting and falling down and getting up and falling down again to get what you dreamt for in life, that's what life is all about. None of us have an easy road. Many of us don't know the torturous road that many of us have gone through.
Yeah.
But you, I think, once you get over this, it's a 1 year or 2 year journey where you're going to be triumphant.
Yes.
You could be a motivational speaker. I think you can be an inspiration that can uplift the community. And for many people who would have received their cancer diagnosis, you say, lay in their bed and say, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Give them that fight that maybe they didn't want to fight. For someone who wanted to keep it a secret, and the most important thing at that time would to have family, friends, neighbors, church members, support. Maybe now they'll be able to open up, because you know what? The Drake to Neil Cargill, who seemingly had everything, is going through this tragedy. And look, he has no issue with opening up and seeing himself as vulnerable and showing all his emotions and everything else. If he can do it, then I can do it.
So the first thing I would want to say, just to create an understanding as to why that's so important, is create a common denominator. I am human, just like you.
Yes.
I'm no greater or better than you. I am no more insulated than you are for disease, as this is obviously teaching me and showing you.
Yes. We can have all the medical knowledge in the world. We can have all the money in the bank. It doesn't matter.
It is not providing any amount of Teflonism to not be affected by disease or illness. And it is affecting me as I speak right now. I am talking to the Bahamian people with one lung.
Yes.
And I know at some point in the show we'll get to this journey and how I'm sitting here now post-surgery, and I will be very open.
We have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks. I'm here with Dr. Tenille Cargill.
Blessed. Good evening, Dr. Pinto.
Good evening.
I was sitting right here in the shop. I listened to this human story. So, of course, I have to appreciate somebody like this young man coming on and humanizing these types of scenarios, right?
Yes.
And I was impressed with his narratives, and so it reminded me of something that I read for a while when I was a child. I think it's in Ecclesiastes, and it says that any man a wise man thinketh about death, right? And a fool, basically, this is not a word, a fool only thinks about pleasure and not the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so as much as we hate to believe, there will always be a denial of death. And so I was hoping people listening to the areas would always realize that, because I guess politics are a way of making people forget that. So we all end up at PMH or some other place or a demise, right? So it's good to be wise, you know. But I just thought this is very important for him to mention that, so we could really see what we're all facing, life and death. I don't know who all Fred, but it basically happens, Dr. Pinto. After 60, the body begins to change. You know, I was having venous problems, right?
Yes.
And so I run and jog and cycle all my life, but when I actually read 12 into it, it says it doesn't matter. It just happens naturally with elasticity, et cetera, after certain exposure. You understand what I'm saying, Doc?
I do.
Everything is inevitable. And so the reason for me saying that is, why can't we as humans in this human journey govern ourselves then? You know, we all become wise in the time of demise, like when we open our eyes and later on, you know, Dr. Ben Dove being in the hospital, people died in front of me, in the back of me, you understand? So I'm able to see the human journey. But I share this. One thing I realized, when I came over to the hospital after spending a month and a week or so, right?
Yes.
I was on my way home and I was driving with a friend. And I just kind of look at the world different. And everything around me after being confined for so long, it looked kind of like a lot of people were living meaningless lives, just moving up and down. But as time passed, you become absorbed right back into the everyday mainstream. But I work a lot. Right
well, now, I'm sure after being in hospital for a month, you appreciate the small things. Fresh air, sunlight.
But when you do a show on the prostate, I would like to say that virtually, I really discovered that when you stop drinking beers altogether, you get a better response and you're able to train your bladder much better. And also that cannabis helps with retraining the bladder, believe you me or not. Give thanks, yeah.
Thank you for your call and your inspiring words. So I want to also quote Buddha. Every experience, no matter how bad it seems, holds within it a blessing of some kind. The goal is to find it. So just from your experience, Dr. Tenille Cargill, Tenille, God may have intended you, as I said, to be a beacon of hope and inspiration to others battling not just cancer, but heart attack, stroke, diabetes. We all have our blows and our things that we have to overcome. So your voice might have been destined to be a call to action for cancer screening that may, over the years, save hundreds of lives. So we got to look at the positive. So there's not one single thing that has happened to any of us or will happen to any of us that will be wasted. So we must look at every single crisis, difficulty, setback and challenge, every joy-filled moment, every drop of happiness, everything is there showing up to make you who you were meant to be.
Yeah.
So this very well, if you could look at it in a positive way, it's difficult, I'm sure, down the journey, but I think it'll be easier to look at it once you've triumphed over this hurdle. But maybe this was your destiny. Maybe you were meant for greater things. You were doing great things already in the community, but maybe you were meant for greater things. Maybe you were meant to save lives by providing cancer awareness. Maybe you were meant to save lives by being a community advocate for health.
Yeah.
We have one of the most unhealthy nations in the world in terms of obesity, in terms of comorbidities, non-communicable diseases, in terms of cancer incidence, whether it's breast, colon, prostate, lung. I think that you can do a lot for a lot of people, and you are doing that already. So let's talk about the surgery. It was obviously a nerve-wracking experience. I think I spoke to you 2 days before the surgery, and you were holding strong. But what was it like days before the surgery? Did you spend time with the family the day before the surgery?
Yes. So first and foremost, you know, whenever you're going, this is a huge undertaking, right? So you have to have the conversation. You have to be very real with yourself and your family members. And there's no routine or run-of-the-mill procedure. It could be simple. It could be complex. It can have many complications. The risk of life and death is within that moment. And so you have to accept all of these things. You have to process this. And you have to allow you be very open with your family. You have to allow them to appreciate that, hey, this is the real deal. This is a big deal. And going through that process, I will say to the general public, you know, having that support team is so important as you make this journey. And it allows it to be that much more palatable for you because your nerves are on you. I went to the pre-op screenings that were necessary. So remember, keep it in context. Tuesday, possibly that Friday, it ended up being the 13th, the Monday.
Okay.
At Doctor's Hospital.
And was that weekend before one of the most difficult weekends of your life?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So all of this.
And I'm sure it was difficult for your children, particularly your older children who had a greater understanding of what was happening.
Yeah, daddy's their hero.
Yes.
You know, they can put it in context. And I'm ill.
Yes.
And I'm having that conversation, that very tough and difficult conversation with them. But I'm being very open, transparent. And I wanted them to receive it as raw as it could be. But I wanted them to also know in that very moment that I was being strong enough for them to be strong for me.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, that made all the difference when I realized that they had grasped it and they were prepared to fight with me.
Okay. That means everything.
So that meant the world.
You're going into surgery. Mm-hmm. What were those moments like?
All right, so...
you were cognizant of the fact that, although it's unlikely that you may never wake up again?
I was very cognizant of that. Like I said, I've always been on the other side of this table.
Yes.
Surgical assisting was a part of my calling as well. Yeah. So I've been in and out of operating theater, and I've been there when persons have not made it.
And I'm sure you've even assisted Dr. Sands in the past. So it comes full circle.
Yes. It comes full circle.
Yes.
As a surgical assistant. But keeping the positivity, the mental fortitude, I think was the undertone or the underbelly of the prayer warriors and the spiritual strength. I could not have done that alone. The Bahamas was praying for me. My family was there for me. And it was being lifted up in that moment in all the prayer groups. I can tell you there were people praying for me I've never met in my life. I don't know them. They're calling my name. At night, they're praying.
And your daughter was a godsend in getting a GoFundMe.
Listen.
And the response was overwhelmingly positive, and it's still there. So we're going to talk about the financial hurdles that you're going to overcome in that.
As well.
Yes, yes.
But this preparation of surgery in that moment, I couldn't have done it without that being lifted up and those coming and standing in the gap. I was at my lowest and my weakest. And that took a village. That took a community. That took a country.
And what did Dr. Sands find when he was...
When he was there?
Operating, yes.
All right, so we spoke about the images of what he thought he saw or what he knew he saw. And then now let's put it in context of what he was confronted with when he opened me up. So I had a procedure called a thoracotomy where he entered my chest cavity from behind my left shoulder. I didn't give you any visuals for you to show online, but he opened my chest from behind, from the back. He got in. He saw the mass, the two masts at the top. It ended up being a smaller one, a third. What he didn't see was how the proximity to my heart.
Yes.
Of the ones that obviously on the left side, that portion of the chest cavity houses the heart.
And he did, in fact, remove some of the pericardium, which is the covering of the heart, muscle.
Right. So he
heart.
Created a pericardial window. So he created a hole in my heart to dissect away. And I must give him his props through the divine process of his gifted hands. He was able to dissect off the mass that was resting on my heart and leave a small window in my heart during this process. I also had during that process, so that would have been the mass removal.
And with the involvement of the thoracic.
Yes, so he took out the third rib and also the fourth rib.
Okay.
Posteriorly, and he also took the lower portion of my lung. He did a lobectomy.
Okay.
So he removed my lower lung.
Was he able to get clear margins, or did he leave some of the cancer
in
situ?
He was confident, and both himself and Dr. Ramphal, who assisted him, another pair of gifted hands. As his co-surgeon, they were able to get everything, in their opinion, that was there with clear margins.
The most important next step, obviously, is waiting on the pathology because
yes.
That would make all the difference in the world.
Yeah,
so
the waiting game.
I've rotated through thoracic surgery and residency, so I know all the different types of lung cancer, and I've seen every scenario, including ones very similar to yours. I've worked in high volume centers where one pathology can mean 5% 5-year survival. Another one could be 99%.
Yes.
So let's talk about the positive things.
Yeah.
Where God was on your side. Where
all the way.
When I knew about your diagnosis, I hoped it was a carcinoid tumor. Because I know that has the very best prognosis. In fact, it could be as high as 99%.
Yes.
And let's talk about what pathology did you have?
All right. So within the procedure, they do something called a frozen section. Yes. Right? So that was done, sent down to the... So my entire medical care happened at Doctor's Hospital. So they did the frozen section within the procedure. Like you said, they got the margins. And then obviously there's that process of prepping the sample to be sent off.
Yes.
All of this takes time. So they would have closed me up, sent it off, and then the waiting starts.
And then you woke up with, obviously, chest tubes.
Yes. I woke up, so this is a different set of trauma now. This is more of the physical pain and mental trauma component with the emotional component at play as well.
Do you remember the moment when you did wake up? What were your thoughts?
I said to myself, when are we going to begin?
Okay.
And that says, that's a testament to the anesthesiology team at Doctor's Hospital, Dr. McCartney. I'm not sure if Dr. Weish was there, Dr. Nemore, I definitely know, so was involved, and the entire anesthesiology and theater staff, to their professionalism and the level of care that I received, because I was actually wondering, okay, when are we going to start with these people standing around me? And the procedure was over.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And the first few days, was it a very painful ordeal?
So there's a component of this that I want to be very open with the Bahamian people that I would have been able to experience. And medicine, or being medically inclined in the medical profession, actually made it that much more difficult for me, was knowing that I was not out of the woods yet. All right. So I did the surgery. And the first few hours afterwards, there was difficulty controlling my blood pressure, okay, and also maintaining my volume intake through IV, and also the after or side effects of some of the meds from the procedure in controlling blood pressure. I think that was for about 12 hours post surgery. And so they did an excellent job in ICU. Maintaining my blood pressure, and I'm sitting there going through all of these thought processes while I drift in and out of what I considered my near death, see the light at the end of the tunnel type thing. Am I going? Am I coming?
Well, I mean, sitting there in ICU where the experience is not a good one, obviously, for many reasons, but you're always hearing blinking of lights, noises going off.
Yes.
Nurses interrupting you. You don't get a moment peace. But there is obviously an element of solitude where you think about
everything.
What is my future going to be like? What is the meaning of life? What am I fighting for? Obviously, you're thinking about your kids. You're thinking about your sister, your
everything
brothers.
To live for, you're thinking about.
Yes, yes.
Because it's a part of the fight.
But let me just put it, as I said earlier, all the little other problems that you had in your life
drifted away. Well,
your car wasn't starting.
Insignificant.
All that meant nothing. All that washed away.
I just wanted to live.
Yes.
The
famous saying, don't sweat the small things. Life is too short.
Too short.
So there's a lot of negativity out there. If it means separating away from someone who's negative in your life, you got to do it.
Yeah.
Not everyone is meant to be in your life forever. And some people change and circumstances change. If you have negativity, if people do not want the best for you, you got to step away from that. You got to shed dead weight, as they say, or negativity out of your life. We don't have enough time on this earth to be burdened by negative people telling you that you're no good. You're not going to wishing bad things on you. You want
Facts. All
positivity. Even if that means it's a small group, that's all you need. You're ride or die.
Yeah. That inner core, that sanctum of individuals that you know are all that you need, is the army required to pull through. Negativity, like you said, has no space, no place in this healing process and this new perspective and this new lease on life.
What was obviously more than just the initial diagnosis and the shock, what was the most difficult thing, I would say, from my perspective, probably telling your children, but second to that would be waiting on the pathology, because that means, am I going to live or am I not going to live?
Yeah.
Essentially, we're realists.
Yeah. So obviously when you come out of a surgery, okay, you're living, right? You're back on earth.
But obviously if you hear that it was involving the muscle of the heart,
right?
You have to be.
Yeah. So those are the immediate thoughts. I'm like, you know, you took a piece of what? Yeah. My heart? Well, my ribs are gone. So you're thinking these things from the physical component, then the waiting game of the pathology, right? And you spoke a bit about the five-year percentiles associated with survival. All right, so am I going to live is always in the back of your mind. And how long am I going to live?
Is there a cure at the end of the road?
Is there a cure, yeah. Right? And all of this rests on the sampling, the pathology. So these things take time. That took about, I would say, roughly 3 weeks, the 21 days or so to get back. And so let me also say this. Having a physician or having a relationship with your physician where you're communicating. Dr. Sands never left a day unturned without communicating. Hey, once I get it, you're going to get that information.
Yes.
And so I think that made the world of a difference too. Because while he's talking to the pathologist, it just so happened, and here's God again, right? The pathologist was at a conference and had access to... at this conference of global pathologists in a room where they could talk about my case. And, you know, so when my sample went off, I'm getting some real-time information from Dr. Sands as these people talk about, you know, the specimen as pathologists do and the uniqueness of this specimen. And so I'm getting this real-time feedback. I don't know if that's good or bad for everybody, but I'm that person. I want the information. And it helped ease my nerves a lot.
Well, I think another important thing to tell the community is that you, with the means in every way to go anywhere in the world, you stayed at home and you received world-class
care
and surgery at home.
Yes.
It was the Bahamian nurses who were taking care of you in ICU, the Bahamian intensivists who were taking care of you post-op, the Bahamian anesthetists who prepped you and got you through the surgery, the Bahamian surgeon, Dr. Dwayne Sands. Oh, a lot of people, and obviously because of his political life, I don't know him in that light, but I've known him 30 years and he's always been a humble person. Yeah. He's always cared about everybody and he's always going the extra mile.
Don't get me wrong. He's a political beast, right? So I'm in groups with him. So he and I were sparring for months at end in these groups. We're going back and forth, and just sort of person's doing PLP, and I'm telling him, you ain't gonna win. I don't know why you run from Lizzie. Jobet got you, and I having these types of conversation with the man that I didn't know.
Was going to save your life.
Was going to save my life.
Yeah.
And this is why we can't get so spent and caught up on this politics to the extent of which we remove ourselves again from the human element of who we are.
Yes.
One people.
Correct.
While all of that has its place, I don't think that it ever should get in the midst of your true reality and us being each other's keepers as a people.
Very well said. So let's fast track to where you did get the pathology. And I did highlight that it was excellent news. So let's tell the public that.
So when we're looking at the multidisciplinary approach of both, my diagnosis and my management, we it would be remiss of us if we were to leave out the oncology team, the groups of individuals, Dr. Curling and TurnQuest team, that are helping guide me through this process, and also the internists, Dr. DeVoe from Oak Tree, Dr. Asazwa from Sea Grapes. Dr. Sharon Thompson, who's a sister and a colleague of mine, all of these persons are reaching out and talking to somebody along with Dr. Sands. And so I get this news that, hey, we think that it's a neuroendocrine tumor of carcinoid. So now to put that in context and with your cardiothoracic experience and having rotated through the discipline, it is possibly the best diagnosis.
It is the best.
In a situation of lung cancer of this nature.
Yes.
Particularly
when you think about involvement of the heart muscle, the pericardium.
Yes.
That in itself, particularly if the cancer goes into the fluid around the heart, where you get a malignant pleural pericardial effusion.
Yeah.
That prognosis, you may not even have 6 weeks. You might not even have 3 months. So you are very blessed in so many ways. So I think you are death in the face.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to, I know, let me take away, not thank you, I know you're going to come out stronger and better on the other side. I think that it's going to change you as a person, where you mentioned you were going through marital strife and everything else, and this was going on and that seemed to be the worst thing in the world. Now you put it in perspective, you know what? You still have your beautiful, healthy 5 kids.
Yeah.
You're going to regain your health. You have an education that not many people were ever afforded.
Yeah.
You have a family who love you. You have a community. I don't think you realize how much the community really loves
I'm
you.
I'm still learning.
You're still learning.
I'm still learning
so
about large.
That lift you
extended
and be the wings beneath your wings, as as the song will say. And I think that you need to continue to reach out. And there are a lot of people there bundled under the blankets at home with a cancer diagnosis that don't know what to do. Everything is overwhelming. You have faced one of the worst possible diagnoses in the face, and you're coming out on the other on this side. Obviously, the journey is not going to be over right now. It's going to be an ongoing thing. We're going to talk about the finances of it all.
Yeah.
What is next? Is it immunotherapy? Is it chemotherapy? Is it radiation? Is it all of the above? Do you need any more surgical interventions?
I'll start with the last statement first, question first. From what I understand, at present, all of the cancer was removed, and I don't anticipate needing any further surgical intervention. Thank the Lord. What, in regards to the treatment, the neuroendocrine, and just for the listeners, neuroendocrine references the nerve tissue and the hormonal tissue, or the hormonal aspect of the nature of this particular tumor, mass, whatever you want to call it. It responds very well to a certain type of immunotherapy that is presently available. And with the advancement of technology, the cure rates are very high when dealing with this carcinoid.
So essentially they reprogram your white cells to kill the cancer cells, which is groundbreaking. It's been a almost a miracle cure over the decades, and it's growing by leaps and bounds in terms of our understanding of diseases, in terms of genetics. Mm-hmm. Every cancer is different, and we need to not just with a broad paintbrush fight it the same way for everyone else. We have to look at the molecular level and determine how we're going to aggressively fight it and get rid of it. And not only that, we want to make sure that there's never any recurrence.
Correct.
We want to make sure it's something in your rear view mirror. But as I say, you are our inspiration. And I'm going to mention something else.
Mm-hmm.
We have a friend going back 30 years ago. And this is someone I'll even say was a friend going back for me 45 years ago. And that's Dr. Finn Farquharson, a friend of ours in medical school.
Yes.
I'm speaking about his case because he's being very upfront and forthcoming, just as you have been.
Yes. And a Bahamian.
And a Bahamian,
yes.
Yeah, so he went to Queen's College with mm-hmm. and his brother, Leif, is now a justice. And he went on to be a radiologist in Manchester, United Kingdom. He stayed on. He was working there. He was in the middle of a radiology meeting, had a blinding headache. They took him to the emergency room. They found that he had one of his carotid arteries was obstructed by a plaque. He had developed a stroke. They took him for immediate intervention, did a thrombectomy. He basically was hemiplegic, wasn't able to talk, problems with understanding because of the side of the brain that was involved. He couldn't move his right arm. He couldn't move his right leg. He went on through physiotherapy and everything else with a positive spirit, relearning essentially how to talk, mm-hmm. how to put phrases together, how mm-hmm. to walk, how to use his arm again.
Yeah.
And he had drawbacks where he had seizures and everything else back in hospital. But he went on, and you can look at it, and he'll be proud for Bahamas to look at it because he's very forthcoming, as he wants to be a beacon of hope, just as you are, Tenille.
Yeah.
That if you put Finn Farquharson YouTube, he talks about his journey with stroke. I think it was 2 years later, then 4 years later, and how he's improved and how he's continued to improve. Yeah. And I spoke to Finn last week. He says he's going to be listening today.
Okay.
And he says that,
hey, Finn, if you're out there, send in my love, bro.
And he says that you have similar journeys, although you have cancer, you had stroke, and he's still ongoing, that you're an inspiration to him. And I said that he's an inspiration to me. And I think you can say that Finn, so at the age of 43, imagine to have a stroke, not being able to work again, when you, one of the very few Bahamian radiologists, fully qualified radiologists, it's got to be that, because we were with him in the libraries, killing ourselves, sacrificing.
Like they say in Jamaica, beating books.
Beating books to try to reach that goal and then to go to the next level and then to go to the next level. And it was a trying time and residency is held to reach that, become a consultant, becoming an attending, and then for that to happen, and he still has a positive outlook.
Yes.
And he's an inspiration and a hero to me, just as you are. Yes. And I think you're a hero to many. But as we mentioned, immunotherapy could be $25,000, $30,000 a month.
Easily. One shot.
And your journey's probably going to be over $1 million. And as you mentioned, you don't have a... You do have a GoFundMe.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how the community can reach out and try to help you financially, as you've helped so many?
Yeah. So my daughter, Jayla, would have set up a GoFundMe online. It's out there.
So how do they just go to the GoFundMe account and put your name, to Neil Cargill?
Yeah. Okay. My name, to Neil Cargill, it'll pop up a dollar. More than the financial component, even if you don't have it.
Or a prayer for you.
A prayer, man. That has kept me and pushed me through.
Yes.
I think that is really what's driving the divine purpose within me now to even come here with you and speak. I let the people know I put this off, initially.
I've not had to face hurdles that you face, but I've had a knockdown and this one coming after me, that one come after. That's just part of having success. But when I look at it, everything pales in comparison.
Everything.
As one of my heroes, Dr. Reginald Niemoyer, says, nobody park cars. So if you're not doing anything,
famous song.
no one's going to be saying anything negative about you. So that's part of my inspiration for doing this radio show, and I'm glad that you're on. I want you to come back and even be a co-host.
Yeah, man.
We don't have to talk about the cancer journey in itself, but there's so many other things that you, as a physician, let's tackle obesity. Yes. Let's tackle hypertension.
Let's start with cutting out sugar.
Let's have a positive impact in our society. And there's so many ways that we can do it together. And I would like to have an open invitation for you to be a future guest host anytime you're available, and to come back and update us on your cancer journey. And
thank you.
My prayers are with you. You are an inspiration to me, Tanil. Yes. You're always being a fighter, and you need to continue that fight.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Bahamas, for listening. And I pray that you found some substance in this message moving forward that would motivate you to stay positive in this fight. And we'll fight this together.
God bless you and have a very safe week. Bahamas, this is Urologist Speaks with my guest of honor, Dr. Tanil Cargill. And this is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. Good night.
Live stronger with the help of Dr.